WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Linda Kenyon.
What we have been hearing is this intense sort of barrage of fire overhead.
That's the BBC's Anna Foster on the border between Israel and Lebanon, talking about the exchanges between the Iran-backed Hezbollah militants in Lebanon and Israel. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan tells CBS's Face the Nation this kind of escalation is why the U.S. is moving a second aircraft carrier group into the region to try to deter the war between Israel and Hamas from spreading even further.
We are concerned about proxy forces. Lebanese Hezbollah, proxy force of Iran, is there a raid on Israel? Northern border with considerable military capacity and a history of attacking the state of Israel. We have seen in the last few days skirmishes across that northern border that only enhances the risk of escalation. But of course, we can't rule out that Iran would choose to get directly engaged some way. We have to prepare for every possible contingency.
Civilians on both sides of the conflict between Israel and Hamas are suffering. This Israeli woman is distraught over those taken hostage by Hamas.
Children without mother, there is mother without children, there is a husband without wife. We have to do everything to bring them back.
While this British woman living in Gaza is terrified by the Israeli airstrikes.
I'm like really in fear. I just have to have the thought of me dying in a bomb in Gaza.
In the U.S., demonstrations over the war in the Middle East have been taking place all over the country. CBS's Christian Benavides has the story.
Let's go!
Growing tensions in Los Angeles kept police on high alert. Fida Mahdi says a family member was killed in Gaza.
I mourn my uncle. He's human and he deserves to be known and not be in pieces on the street.
In Boston, this Israeli student was also mourning his loved ones.
I lost five friends and colleagues at the recent attack. One of my friends who was missing, we've heard that he was found dead on the ground.
Ukrainian officials say six people have been killed in Russian attacks on the country in the past 24 hours. Guided bombs hit key infrastructure in the city of Kherson, sparking a partial blackout and disruption to the area's water supply. Meanwhile, the Russian Defense Ministry has announced Ukraine launched 27 drones in an overnight attack on Western Russia and that 18 were shot down. Climate change. How is it affecting youth?
A new report from the American Psychological Association says climate change can have lifelong impacts on the mental health of young people. Research shows that extreme weather events can cause PTSD, and long-term effects of climate change can increase the risk of anxiety, depression, and other mental health impacts.
That's CBS's Matt Piper, and this is CBS News.
You need to hire? Indeed is with you every step of the way. Helping you attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. People advocating against gerrymandered political maps in Wisconsin hope to derail a new Republican effort to overhaul the process. They say the so-called Iowa-style plan would make matters worse. Mike Moan reports.
Political researchers have long noted that Wisconsin has some of the most gerrymandered maps in the U.S., and Republican lawmakers have controlled the process in recent cycles. They're now pushing through a new plan to create an independent panel to draw new boundaries. But Yuseli Flores of the Wisconsin Fair Maps Coalition says it contains loopholes that would allow the GOP to essentially keep the reins.
And it just seems like a huge power grab that could permanently change the process for how we draw our state maps, and it just feels like it's going to be detrimental to our communities.
The coalition and Democratic Governor Tony Evers have embraced the idea of an independent process, but they contend this Republican plan doesn't have a high enough threshold to prevent the legislature from intervening. They're urging the Senate to reject the bill, which recently cleared the Assembly. GOP leaders say it's an opportunity to adopt changes constituents have been demanding. But skeptics say this is strictly a response to the state Supreme Court and its new liberal majority agreeing to hear challenges to the most recent maps. Flores says while that plays out, the public doesn't need to be excluded from a rushed attempt to establish new rules.
And what we need is a more independent, transparent, and inclusive process, rather than what they showed us.
If the state Senate gives its approval, Governor Evers has vowed to veto the bill. Meanwhile, the Wisconsin Supreme Court is scheduled to hear arguments in the redistricting case next month. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Don't let biased algorithms, or degree screens, or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes, don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skill through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Crute. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your brother. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. This is the second hour of Morning Cannolis on this Saturday, October 14th, 2023. Thank you for joining me in this our 67th broadcast. I'm joined in the studios here in Waukesha by my wonderful producer, Anya, and together we're taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. We'll also take your text messages about things we're chatting about during the course of this next hour, focusing in particular upon some of the litigation pending in the courts of America, and then also talking about the United States Supreme Court. As always, we're talking about the most important issues, the stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America, and yes, indeed, around the world as well. Thank you for joining me this morning. Thank you, as always, for your thoughtful comments and questions about the subject matters on our syllabus. That includes some summaries in the next couple of segments of what's going on in some of the courts pending around the court cases pending in our nation's courts. Let's talk in particular about this civil case pending in the Manhattan State Court. This, again, is the litigation brought by the Attorney General of the State of New York, Letitia James, charging that Donald Trump and his family members, his corporation, engaged in valuation misrepresentations and fraud when it came to assessing and reporting on the values of various properties implicating state law. That's the predicate for the Attorney General's prosecution. A lot of this, again, focusing upon what actually happened inside of the Trump Organization at the time of these representations. This past week, Alan Weisselberg, again, the CFO, previously convicted in the federal court for similar violations of those involved bookkeeping, misrepresentations, and fraud. He's already a convicted felon. He appeared in this case to talk about the circumstances under which various representations were made about the valuations of these properties. And he took the stand on Tuesday, day six of this financial fraud trial, and basically testified that Donald Trump had grossly exaggerated the size of his penthouse apartment on financial statements made to banks and insurers. So Weisselberg was fairly clear about that particular aspect of this. In particular, in October of 1994, according to Weisselberg, Trump signed a document certifying the triplex apartment was 10,996 square feet. But in 2012, many years later, he listed the apartment at 30,000 square feet. And that, according to, supports the charges brought by the prosecutors in this particular case. So Weisselberg, again, called as a prosecution witness to support this notion that the misrepresentations have been made. However, along the way, of course, Weisselberg attempting to limit the damage, if you will, to Donald Trump along the way. He said this. He said, "I never even thought about the apartment." He added, "It was not something that was more important to me when looking at $6.5 billion of net worth." Again, indicating that while this happened, while this happened, the overall focus of his was upon the overall management of the company at that time. Alan Weisselberg's testimony, important again in establishing the mechanisms through which this fraud was perpetrated. Alan Weisselberg in a tough position because he plainly wants to have it both ways, if you will, wants to support in some ways his former boss, his continuing boss, which is a part of the bias that he has. He remains on the Trump payroll even to this day, but also being called as a prosecution witness and knows that if he lies, if he provides information under oath that is not true, he can be subject to a prosecution, a state prosecution, for perjury as well. And so Alan Weisselberg's testimony important to this case as it goes forward. There was other big news that was going to happen this coming week. We learned just last night about a change in some witness testimony that was going to be scheduled for this coming week. We know as well that Michael Cohen, the former president's fixer and longtime attorney, was going to testify in that same trial about the same kinds of things. According to prosecutors, Michael Cohen was going to come forward and talk once again about the ways in which the Trump organization works, and focusing upon the valuations of these properties. And Cohen was slated to testify on Tuesday. Late last night, he indicated because of a medical issue that would have to be postponed. But he is expected to be another key witness along with Weisselberg in this case. Again, important to establish inside the corporation what people understood, and in particular, what role did Donald Trump play in putting together these evaluations, in knowing about them, in sanctioning them. Again, Michael Cohen going to be testifying at some point down the road in that important case coming out of New York State, the New York fraud case. Again, not a criminal case, but a civil case. We know as well that there was some significant goings-on in the so-called classified documents case. This is a federal case. This is one brought by federal prosecutors, Jack Smith in particular, the special counsel appointed by the attorney general. This is going on in the state of Florida, a federal court there, being presided over by Judge Eileen Cannon, prosecuted once again by Jack Smith's attorneys there, charging not only Donald Trump with violations of classified document laws in the system, charging him with taking documents to which he was not entitled, using them, engaging in other criminal conduct, that case pending once again in Florida, a federal case, but also charging Trump valet, his name is Walt Nauta, N-A-U-T-A, and a property management and manager named Carlos de Oliveira, with efforts to undermine justice, to compromise the safety and security of the videotapes that presumably will be presented during the course of that trial. During the course of recent proceedings, just this past week, Eileen Cannon entertaining some arguments from Jack Smith, from the prosecutors in this case, about potential conflicts of interest brought by, again, the government against the lawyers who are seeking to represent Nauta in particular. The attorney there, his name is Stanley Woodward. And the problem that the prosecutors identify, this so-called conflict of interest, is that Stanley Woodward previously represented many other people also involved in the investigation of this case, some of whom are presumably now cooperating with the government in this matter. Among those, I found him, Yusil Tavares, and you may recall from our previous discussions that Yusil Tavares is the IT fellow. He's the one who was approached by De Oliveira, presumably through the instruction of Nauta, presumably through the instruction of Donald Trump, to seize and destroy the tapes of the movements of these documents in and around the Mar-a-Lago facility. And the concern, of course, is that if Stanley Woodward, again, previously representing Yusil Tavares, who is cooperating with the government, Woodward now representing one of the defendants, Walt Nauta, in this case, that's a conflict of interest. Why? Because at some point, almost certainly, Stanley Woodward acquired through the course of his attorney-client relationship with Yusil Tavares some information about what he knows, and will have an opportunity, presumably, during the course of the trial in which he's now representing a defendant to question his former client on the stand, Yusil, and these other people also providing information to a trial jury. the judge, Eileen Cannon, entertaining argument again from the government, basically seeking to disqualify Stanley Woodward from the continuing representation of Walt Nauta based upon his prior representation of people, including the IT fellow, Yusil Tavares, who are now cooperating, providing this information not only to the grand jury, also presumably to a trial jury there in South Florida. The judge, somewhat frustrated by the length of these conversations, the arguments being engaged in the federal court, not yet making a decision on that particular conflict of interest claim, but also going to impact who is going to be representing people in that case. Major case developments coming out of South Florida just this past week. And then we also know some important issues coming out of the case involving Georgia. And in particular, this is the allegation, the indictment brought by Fannie Willis, to which I made reference previously. Fannie Willis, again, charging 19 different defendants, including Donald Trump, including many, many other actors, for their attempts to violate and their actual violations of Georgia law. That is, again, vindicating the interests of Georgia residents and Georgia citizens in ensuring that their votes are counted properly. This past week, and a part of her response to a request by a fellow named Jim Jordan, who right now is the present nominee to be the next Speaker of the House of Representatives in his capacity as the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. Jim Jordan has previously requested from Fannie Willis information about the conduct of the investigation there in Georgia, about the conduct of the prosecution, plainly trying to push back on what's going on there in Georgia. And in response to those requests from Jim Jordan, again, right now, not only a congressman, but also perhaps the next Speaker of the House, depending upon what the United States Congress, the House of Representatives, does, presumably in the days just ahead, in responding to the request by Jim Jordan for information about her state prosecution, again, this coming out of the United States Congress, the House Judiciary Committee, a scathing response, if you will, from Fannie Willis to Jim Jordan, request for documents and other materials about this investigation, Fannie Willis reiterating, as she has done before, the reasons for refusing to comply with that request. Here's what she said. She said, "A charitable explanation of your correspondence is that you are ignorant of the United States laws and the Georgia Constitution and its code." That's what Fannie Willis is saying to Jim Jordan. "A more troubling explanation," she said, "is that you are abusing your authority as chairman of the Committee of the Judiciary to attempt to obstruct and interfere with a Georgia criminal prosecution." Those are strong words coming from a prosecutor. Again, statements not only pushing back against his request for this information, but telling him that he may in fact be in violation of Georgia law and even the Constitution of the United States of America. Previously, Jim Jordan had accused Fannie Willis of targeting inappropriate federal officials for political reasons, doing other things to undermine her oath of office, not in pursuit of her oath of office, all of that, the subject of a huge amount of pushback just this past week coming out of Georgia. All of those things happening out of that state criminal prosecution there as well. And we also know that coming out of the January 6th criminal prosecution, some important issues related to likely defenses coming up in that case. When we come back after this break, I'm going to talk about Jack Smith's attempt to identify exactly what the nature of the defense is going to be and whether or not an advice of counsel defense will be raised by the defendants in that case. Stay with us for that continuing discussion right after this break.
Have you noticed bad behavior has become normalized at interscholastic athletic events? Some fans seem angry. They lack civility toward one another. Some even get aggressive and unruly. Time out! What is going on? This has to stop. Let's not forget, school sports aren't just about winning. And they're definitely not an excuse to take your frustrations out on the official or the opponent. They're about teaching lessons like perseverance, respect, and empathy, so students can learn and grow as people, not just as players. We all have a role to play in setting a good example for our students and teaching them these important values. So fans, it's time to step up your game and behave positively at interscholastic athletic events in Wisconsin.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
The Todd Alba Show.
What makes our society great is that we can believe in something bigger than ourselves. Doesn't matter whether it's a soccer team or whether it's a political movement or whether it's a public school, whether it's a neighborhood PTA, a bake sale. It's about interacting with our friends and neighbors and making our communities better for having come together around a common cause.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local civic media radio station and on the...
Updates about the major cases pending in state and federal courts involving the former president and others, not only in connection with January 6th, but also classified documents, attempts to defraud in the state of New York. And now turning to this major case, it was brought again by a federal grand jury in the District of Columbia against Donald Trump, singular defendant to date in that case, as indicated before in connection with our discussion about the fake electors this morning. Highly likely that at some point Jack Smith will either supersede in that particular case or bring entirely new indictments again through the grand jury process against some of the unindicted co-conspirators in that case, six of them in particular, probably against other people and maybe down the road against fake electors as well. Again, as I said before, not compromising in any way a parallel or more immediate state prosecution of those fake electors here in the state of Wisconsin. In that January 6th federal criminal prosecution, now pending in front of District Court Judge Tanya Chutkan in the District of Columbia, some other activity also important to the future defense of that case by the defendant, Donald Trump. And in particular, lawyers on the team assembled by Jack Smith to charge and to prosecute this case against Donald Trump, submitted a memorandum this past week requesting that Judge Chutkan require Donald Trump through his attorneys to declare whether he intends to put forth a so-called advice of counsel defense when the case goes to trial. And you might think, well, gee, how is that possible? And the answer is there are all sorts of reasons why in this pretrial setting that the parties have rights to understand what the other side will be doing. Among the most important rights, of course, defense has the right to virtually all the discovery that the government has assembled during the course of the investigation. That's called Brady material, Jenks material, all kinds of names for this discovery. Basically, the government turns over all kinds of information. And we're in that period right now where the parties attempt to winnow and sift through all of that and make requests of the other side about what's going to happen next. There can be motions to dismiss, motions to suppress. Among those, Jack Smith, again, in response to what he has heard out there about a possible defense, an advice of counsel defense, Jack Smith asking that the court order that Donald Trump's attorneys describe with particularity whether or not their client, Donald Trump, intends to rely on this advice of counsel defense. And what does that defense partake of, basically? Basically, it says this: that I was not criminally responsible. I didn't have the intent to engage in the particular crime with which I'm charged because I did what? I relied upon the advice, the counsel, the direction given me by my attorney. My attorney told me this was okay, and for that reason, I decided to do this kind of conduct, but that absolves me of the criminal responsibility to engage in the crime as it is charged It is a legitimate defense. It is out there. It's fairly narrow in its application, if you think about it, just because it happens to apply most often when there is some arcane or very, very specific kinds of laws that only maybe attorneys would know about, tax laws, for example, corporate laws. Typically, advice of counsel will not come into play when, in fact, one is charged with something like bank robbery or drug dealing, something large and broad, where everyone knows it's in violation of the law to do those kinds of things, but it is available. And in particular, here, again, Jack Smith's team is asking the judge to ask and require the Trump attorneys to declare with specificity whether or not this advice of counsel defense will be raised by Donald Trump in response to the indictment against him. And in particular, in the filing, prosecutors said that if Trump uses that defense at trial, it would then allow them, that is the government prosecutors, to seek additional testimony from about 25 people, some 25 other witnesses are out there, including significantly some members of Donald Trump's family who withheld information, communications, and documents based on assertions of attorney-client privilege. And that's all in the pleading, again, filed this past week. This is the reason why Jack Smith wants this information, because it opens up the door to get testimony from people who've otherwise said, I have got an attorney-client relationship. That relationship cannot be breached. That privilege cannot be breached. And for that reason, we cannot testify. Well, Jack Smith argues, if you're going to raise the advice of counsel defense, that is, that my attorney told me to do that, you are effectively waiving that privilege. You're basically saying, I'm going to tell you about what my attorney said to me during the course of our discussions, our negotiations about that. And you have basically stripped yourself of that advice, that attorney-client privilege, opening up the door to all the rest of this. That's the legal theory. That's the reason why this is so very important. Using this defense would invalidate, effectively, those claims of attorney-client privilege by these 25 or more witnesses who have raised this already. And so Jack Smith, again, seeking a directive from the district court judge to the attorneys representing Donald Trump to state affirmatively whether or not Donald Trump is going to be saying that he relied upon the advice of counsel in engaging in any of the activities that he's charged with in that four-count indictment against him. Again, all those kinds of things that we have talked about at great length before. A significant move this past week, because it's going to define in major ways not only the conduct of these pretrial proceedings, but also who's going to testify at trial. And so the judge, Judge Shutkin, obviously receiving from the Trump team a response to this, pushing back on this requirement. But nonetheless, she is going to decide at some point, Tanya Chutkan will, about whether or not she is going to issue an order directing the provision of this information to the prosecutors as a part of this pretrial process. Again, she is presiding over this federal case pending the District of Columbia. We know Eileen Cannon also now presented by this unrelated issue involving a conflict of interest in the Mar-a-Lago documents case. That one also federal in nature, but pending in Florida. Lots of things going on in the federal courts just this past week, the state courts as well. All of those as a part of our rule of law updates here on Morning Cannolis. When we come back, finally, in our last two segments, we're going to talk about the United States Supreme Court, things on its docket just this past week, important things to know as we understand about what's going on at our highest court. Stay with us for that engagement.
CBS News special report. The U.S. has deployed a second aircraft carrier to the Eastern Mediterranean. National Security Spokesman Jake Sullivan tells CBS's Face the Nation it's been done to keep the fighting from expanding to a wider area.
That is part of what has motivated the president's movement of these assets, to send that clear message of deterrence, to make clear that this war should not escalate. And that no other actor should seek to exploit this situation.
Through an interpreter, this 15-year-old boy in Gaza says he wonders if he'll ever know what peace feels like.
I can barely stand it, he says. We just want to be secure. Our dream is to live. That's all we want.
This Israeli woman says she's worried about the hostages that Hamas has taken.
Children without mother, there is mother without children, there is a husband without wife. We have to do everything to bring them back.
CBS News Special Report. I'm Peter King.
Have you noticed bad behavior has become normalized at interscholastic athletic events? Some fans seem angry. They lack civility toward one another. Some even get aggressive and unruly. Time out! What is going on? This has to stop. Let's not forget, school sports aren't just about winning. And they're definitely not an excuse to take your frustrations out on the official or the opponent. They're about teaching lessons like perseverance, respect, and empathy, so students can learn and grow as people, not just as players. We all have a role to play in setting a good example for our students and teaching them these important values. So fans, it's time to step up your game and behave positively at interscholastic athletic events in Wisconsin.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
It's the Wild West of how students are using generative AI.
As educators, there's sort of six responses that we can have to these new tools. We could ignore it. Mm-hmm. We could ban it. We can try and outfox it. We can teach about it. We can actually teach it, or we can teach with it. I think the most exciting one, of course, is to teach with it.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Two. And if you miss a show or game.
And we are back here in Morning Cannolis. Thank you for your continuing involvement here with our discussion of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. Always taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. Also soliciting your texts, your written comments, questions about the things that we're chatting about. In these last couple of segments, we're going to chat about the United States Supreme Court, things on its docket, things about which all of us should be attentive because, as we know well, the United States Supreme Court making major decisions, as it has always done, that affect who we are, how we live our lives, and ways we conduct our business, our commerce, our transportation, education, healthcare, privacy rights, all kinds of things out there that implicate the ways in which we deal with each other and have our lives here in the United States of America. This past week, the United States Supreme Court added about 10 to 12 more cases on its docket. Last week, we reported that the United States Supreme Court had in its docket somewhere around 23, 24 cases. This week, it jumped to 36, and again, probably going to settle somewhere around 60 or so by the time that all of this is done. Among other things, among other cases that it added, just this past week was a major additional case having to do with this battle over what's called the Chevron Doctrine. The Chevron Doctrine, we're going to be chatting a lot about that in the future. That Chevron Doctrine is a long-standing judicial principle that basically says that courts, in deciding whether or not the actions of administrative agencies are legitimate or not, whether they're legal, lawful or not, should basically rely upon the decisions and the judgments of administrative agencies, their interpretations of the law, in issues where the Congress, under that law, was silent or was fairly ambiguous, was not clear in terms of what should happen. Courts have traditionally said, we will defer to what the agencies say, and that's called the Chevron Doctrine, coming out of a major Supreme Court case. Major cases now pending in this term of whether or not the Chevron Doctrine should be not only dismantled, but completely discarded, giving judges, federal judges, great authority when it comes to, if you will, second guessing the expertise, the agency experience in making decisions about things in front of them on a regular basis. And so we know that the United States Supreme Court has previously granted cert. It's already got on its document, granted this writ of certiorari to hear a case called Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. And that was concerning the company's fight against a regulation that requires Loper Bright, that is the company, to pay for federal observers aboard their boats. It's a maritime case. And while that particular rule is very important, along the way, the owners of that corporation have asked the court to get rid of the Chevron Doctrine, basically say that what the maritime federal agency has said about payment for these monitors on board should be discarded, and that the deference that's previously been given to those decisions should be gotten rid of. A lower court upheld the regulation under the Chevron Doctrine, but the appeals court basically overturned that decision. So that all before the United States Supreme Court, already pending just this past week, and a new case indicating once again that the Supreme Court highly likely, very interested in this and highly likely to overturn Chevron, which is a huge, huge movement when it comes to federal jurisprudence, decided to grant cert in a new case. This one's called Relentless versus Department of Commerce. It originates from the same fishing boat observer regulation and does, in fact, raise the same kinds of issues. The Chevron issue, that case also now pending before the United States Supreme Court. Interestingly, in connection with ethics before the Supreme Court, Ketanji Brown Jackson had previously been engaged in some decision-making with respect to the case, again, involving Raimondo or Loper Bright Enterprises. In this new case in which she was not involved, she is not going to be recused. And again, it underscores the importance of justices making these decisions about cases in which you don't want the appearance of impropriety or actual impropriety in reaching decisions. Ketanji Brown Jackson getting it just right, saying, you know what, with respect to the earlier case already pending, this Loper Bright Enterprises case, I'm going to recuse myself because of my previous involvement. The new case, the Relentless case, not involved in that one, so she will join 8 other members of the court in deciding that case, both of them obviously focusing on the same issue. In an unusual move just this past week, the Supreme Court has sped up its consideration of these petitions, enabling the justices now to take up these cases sooner than in the normal timeline. And for that reason, this Chevron issue going to loom large, maybe going to be one of the major decisions pending before the United States Supreme Court in this term. We'll get back to that as well during the course of our discussion about the United States Supreme Court. So the United States Supreme Court also will be addressing a major case involving bankruptcy reorganization and whether or not the protections of the bankruptcy court involving fraudulent claims tied to asbestos exposure. That case also now brought into the increasing docket, now up to 36 cases pending before the Supreme Court as of this morning. We know as well, my reference to ethics already, the ethics issue continues to loom large in front of the Supreme Court. No change, regrettably, in the status of that. And what is the status? It's basically stalemate. We know that the United States Senate, coming out of the Senate Judiciary Committee, headed by Dick Durbin, the senior senator from Illinois. Dick Durbin, successful in getting reported out, marked up from the Senate Judiciary Committee, some legislation that would impose upon the Supreme Court a set of rules and regulations, some enforcement mechanisms as well. Also supported, authored by a fellow named Sheldon Whitehouse, another senator there advocating for some ethics rules and regulations for the Supreme Court. That passed out of committee, but obviously going nowhere in the Senate. So congressional efforts to address this problem still not moving forward in any way. Some increasing indications that the court itself, including statements by Elena Kagan recently, that the court continues to work internally on its own decision about whether or not a code of ethics should be imposed. But to date, the Chief Justice not doing any of that. And to date, we do not have a code of ethics of the sort that applies equally to district court judges and to appeals court judges around the country. That code of ethics, which could be applied to the Supreme Court as well, not applying them to this date, again, because of no legislative activity, and most importantly, where this should happen, the self-imposition by the Supreme Court of its own set of ethics rules and regulations. That hasn't happened. That hasn't happened. And because of that, the court still without a code of ethics, even as it undertakes these very important cases before it. So what cases are pending in front of the United States Supreme Court right now? Last week, you know, we talked about three of them involving this case involving Pulsifer. This is the case in which a question about sentencing having to do with the interpretation of the word and or linguistics in front of the Supreme Court. That argued a couple of weeks ago, this CFPB case in which the Supreme Court is wrestling with whether or not the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is legitimately constituted, almost certainly rejecting notions that that particular agency is unconstitutional. And third, this case involving Atchison Hotels, this very interesting case involving the Americans with Disabilities Act, whether a tester who had no intention of staying at the hotel, but testing the applicability of the ADA to statements made by the Atchison Hotels and its online advertisements are consistent with the ADA. That issue also in front of the Supreme Court, obviously coming up for decision down the road. This past week, three additional arguments in front of the Supreme Court. Let's talk about those right now. On Wednesday, perhaps one of the other major cases being decided by the Supreme Court in this term, a case called Alexander versus South Carolina State Conference of the NAACP. Yes, indeed. It's another voting rights case. It's another gerrymandering case. And in particular, this case concerns the interplay between politics and race. And that's why it's somewhat distinguished between the merits of this case and the Alabama case we talked about at great length in the past. That case from the previous term, you will well recall, in which the Supreme Court and a panel of the Fifth Circuit has told the Alabama legislature that they need to go back and redo their gerrymandered lines. Now a cartographer and a special master redrawing those lines for the legislature there because it did not do it on its own. This is another case, this one coming out of South Carolina, raising the same issues, but slightly different as well. This case, again, Alexander versus South Carolina, NAACP, similar to Alabama, again, but also involving some distinct legal principles. And what are those? Well, the Alabama case, again, involved the Voting Rights Act, that landmark civil rights statute that we talk about routinely here. And the one from South Carolina focuses, again, on voting rights, but also on the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. At the start of the first hour here, we talked about that under the 14th Amendment, the ways in which we traditionally invoke and apply the 14th Amendment to ensure equal protection to all people in the United States of America. The two cases, again, arguably tug in some different directions, and we'll see how the court reconciles them, even as the court just this past week was much more skeptical about whether or not the legislature, again, in this case involving South Carolina, had acted improperly under the Equal Protection Clause. And how did this case come about? Well, unanimous three-judge panel of the Federal District Court in South Carolina, Columbia, South Carolina, the state capital, had ruled way back in January that the first congressional district there in the state of South Carolina, which was drawn again after the 2020 census, violated the Constitution by making race the predominant factor. And that's the key to all of this, whether this is race or politics. And Justice Elena Kagan, just this past week, said that that ruling was sound, even though the lawmakers were free to achieve their political goals directly by using data on partisan voting. And specifically, she said this. She said what they could not do, according to Elena Kagan, was achieve those goals indirectly by using data on race. Data on race. She told a lawyer for the lawmakers appearing in front of her that the evidence showed that you were using race as a proxy for politics. And she added that the practice of this practice was fairly curious. Why would map makers, she said, in general and in this case, use race as a proxy to do partisan gerrymandering now that you could do partisan gerrymandering? That was what she was asking. And so the question again is this interplay between race and data used in connection with political gerrymandering. Justice across the ideological spectrum, putting Justice Kagan's comments to one side, agreed, of course, that the Supreme Court can only overturn the lower court's rulings if they rule the lower court was clearly erroneous. And that's the legal status, the legal standard that they're addressing in deciding whether or not what the legislature did was proper or not. And in particular, whether or not the lower court ruling that indeed these cases violated the Constitution by making race a prominent factor, whether that was supported by the evidence in the case. And the Supreme Court, again, not going to overturn this unless that lower court finding was clearly erroneous. And again, several conservative justices indicating that they were prepared to rule that the lower court had committed a clear error, even with that high standard established in these kinds of cases. Amy Coney Barrett, for example, said the court must also take account of two other factors. This according to the Supreme Court Justice Coney Barrett. She said that the plaintiffs bear an exceedingly high burden when they're trying to disentangle race and politics, and that we give the legislature a presumption of good faith. That coming from Amy Coney Barrett. John Roberts, likewise, suggested that the administration's position was novel and sort of surprising. Again, the administration supporting the lower court decision here, finding that there had been a violation of law. He said this, have you ever supported the plaintiffs in a case in which there was no evidence of any direct discrimination, no alternative map, no oddly shaped districts, and a volume of political data? And again, all of that a part of the oral argument just this past week. This new House map moved about 62% of black voters in Charleston County from the first district in this to the sixth district, and moving the percentage of black voters from one district to another. And that seat was the seat that Representative Jim Clyburn has held for about 30 years. He previously served as the whip, the House whip, a major, major figure in the House of Representatives to this day. Significantly, that move accomplished by the legislature, again, overturned by the district court, now an appeal to the Supreme Court, also make that new first district a Republican stronghold. And that's why this interplay between race and politics is so important. In November, Nacy Mace, the Republican incumbent, won re-election there by 14 percentage points. Ms. Mace, of course, also a major figure, as we've seen her recently.
Have you noticed bad behavior has become normalized at interscholastic athletic events? Some fans seem angry. They lack civility toward one another. Some even get aggressive and unruly. Time out! What is going on? This has to stop. Let's not forget, school sports aren't just about winning. And they're definitely not an excuse to take your frustrations out on the official or the opponent. They're about teaching lessons like perseverance, respect, and empathy, so students can learn and grow as people, not just as players. We all have a role to play in setting a good example for our students and teaching them these important values. So fans, it's time to step up your game and behave positively at interscholastic athletic events in Wisconsin.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Timeout.
All right. Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
This is our final segment here in Morning Cannolis this Saturday morning, chatting right before the break about this very significant case, Alexander versus South Carolina State Conference of the NAACP. Looks to be that the Supreme Court, unlike its decision in the Alabama case in the previous term, is in fact going to find that what the legislature did here was permissible, again, based upon some of the tea leaves, some of the comments articulated by the justices in that oral argument just this past week. The justices have described the principal question before it as this. Did that district court, again, the district court finding that the legislature had in fact violated the Constitution by drawing these lines, changing the districts there in South Carolina, did the district court clearly err, and again, that's the standard, in finding that the legislature used a racial target as a proxy for politics? When the record showed, again, this according to the Supreme Court's question here, showed that the legislature was aware of race, that race and politics are highly correlated, and the legislature drew districts based upon election data. Again, the issue is somewhat complicated, but nonetheless, identifying for the first time this question about how you sort through the difference between race and racial animus and racial decisions to act based upon race, those that are premised upon politics. Again, the Supreme Court has said that political decisions are not subject to federal review. Racial discrimination, that's different. And when they're intermixed, what do you do in a case like that? And that was before the Supreme Court, that very issue before the court, just this past Wednesday. Significantly, as an important footnote to that, just this past week in Texas, a redistricting plan was found to have violated the Voting Rights Act. This coming out of a district court over the Southern District of Texas just yesterday, a political redistricting plan violating the Voting Rights Act. The court said that it denies Black and Latino voters equal opportunity to participate in the political process. The court found in particular there, again, this is a district court, that Galveston County eliminated an existing district that had existed for decades there in Texas, even though Blacks and Latinos comprised about 38% of the total population in the county. There, in fact, you do get reminiscences of the Alabama case. The Commissioner Court is the governing body for Galveston County, again, finding that there had, in fact, been a violation of the law, the Voting Rights Act. In that case, perhaps that one, too, will get to the Supreme Court. More likely falls in the category of the case coming out of Alabama, coming out of the Supreme Court this past term. We've got this new case, however, coming out of South Carolina that is going to be interesting to watch because it raises these new issues about the interplay, again, between politics and race when it comes to decision-making by legislators. A couple of other issues before the Supreme Court, both of them argued this past Tuesday, one of them having to do with whistleblowers, in particular, whether or not a whistleblower has to prove some level of intent when it comes to a retaliation made by his or her employer. The case involves a fellow named Trevor Murray. He had sued his employer named UBS Securities. It's a broker dealer based in New Jersey, alleging that his employer had terminated his employment because he reported some alleged fraud. And he came forward and, again, a classic whistleblower situation. Murray claimed that he was targeted for layoffs because he reported this fraud, and identifying these illegal efforts by his colleagues to skew or sway some independent research analysis. A jury had awarded him about $600,000 in back pay, about $250,000 in non-economic compensatory damages. And of course, the employer has pursued that. And the question again before the United States Supreme Court is what one does when it comes to what the burden is upon the employee to show actual retaliatory intent. Eugene Scalia, who is representing the employer in this case, and yes, Attorney Scalia, the son of the former Supreme Court Justice, he was also former Secretary of Labor, who is the attorney, said that Congress did not eliminate a retaliatory intent requirement in the law, and said that the plaintiff still has to show retaliatory intent as a part of its fundamental presentation before getting to the merits of the case. He said that's fundamental discrimination law. Several justices expressed some skepticism about the employer's argument, and they asked how the retaliatory intent standard is not already accounted for inside the burden shifting that's set forth in law. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, for example, said, "What I'm struggling with is trying to understand how causation and intent are different in this world. It seems to me," she said, "that they both get at the same thing." Clarence Thomas, not surprisingly, disagreed with her. It said, "It seems that the substantive statute provides the but-for causation and has an intent requirement." Neil Gorsuch suggested the court could conclude whistleblowers only have to show discriminatory intent, not retaliatory intent, which is what the case is ultimately all about. Gorsuch saying this, he said, "I see discrimination in this statute, and I see whistleblowing activity, and I know there's a causation requirement, but I do not see the retaliation in this statute." Overall, however, the court seemed sympathetic to Murray's argument, and for that reason, we'll see what happens down the road. Again, this issue having to do with what level of intent, retaliatory intent, what is the burden? What is the burden that whistleblowers have in coming forward these days when alleging that they were terminated because of their legitimate activities in identifying criminal activity or other inappropriate activity by their employer? What kind of retaliatory intent does the employer need to show? What is the burden upon the employee to respond to those claims of retaliation by an employee in those kinds of cases, subject to a lot of disagreement among the justices just this past week. And finally, a case also involving something fairly complicated, but having to do with the choice of laws. I will tell you that when I was in law school, one of my favorite classes was choice of law. This case involving that same issue about what kinds of laws do you apply when it comes to different laws in different states. And so this case is called Great Lakes Insurance Company versus Raiders Retreat Realty. And the question whether or not state or federal law should govern in this case has to do with the enforceability of something called the Maritime Choice of Law Clauses. And it seems, as does all of this, highly technical, the kinds of things that only lawyers can decide. But here, for example, a foreign insurance company insured a yacht, and that was owned by a Pennsylvania company. And although neither party of the contract is from New York, the insurance contract selected New York law. And the question there is what should apply, federal law, in this case, Pennsylvania or New York law. We'll be discussing those cases and others in future broadcasts here in Morning Cannolis. Join us every Saturday morning for discussion, not only the Supreme Court, but those other major issues in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Thank you for joining me this morning. Have a good week, everybody.
Have you noticed bad behavior has become normalized at interscholastic athletic events? Some fans seem angry. They lack civility toward one another. Some even get aggressive and unruly. Time out! What is going on?
This has to stop. Let's not forget, school sports aren't just about winning. And they're definitely not an excuse to take your frustrations out on the official or the opponent. They're about teaching lessons like perseverance, respect, and empathy, so students can learn and grow as people, not just as players. We all have a role to play in setting a good example for our students and teaching them these important values. So fans, it's time to step up your game and behave positively at Interscholastic Athletic Events in Wisconsin.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228 EP Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.